And I don't think we talk about farmers' health enough. So I feel like I'm just trying to find ways to connect things we do talk about, which is soil quality, which is product quality, and farmers' health, because I really believe we need to raise the level of that dialogue in our current conversations around agriculture.
May the Forage be with you, a podcast brought to you by the Peace River Forage Association. Welcome to episode 5. I'm your host, Nadia Mori. In today's episode, we talk to Brooke Hayes, who is looking at a possible connection between healthy soils and healthy farmers. Now, before you think that sounds just crazy or weird, let me explain. Brooke's hypothesis is that as soils improve in quality, they produce better products, which in turn brings potentially more income, making the operation more profitable and thus keeping the farmer in more positive spirits and better mental health. To hear Brooke explain her approach more eloquently than me, be sure to tune into part 2 of my interview with her coming out next week. In this first part, though, we touch on why Brooke decided to walk away from a well-established career to look at soils and farmers' mental health, the spectrum of regenerative agriculture and how farmers are moving along it, and where you can hide 90,000 liters of water. Stay tuned for that one. After the interview, we'll take a look at the Forage Fact Sheet Vault and at Forage Fact Sheet number 117 to take a closer look at how adaptations work on the farm. This will be kind of an interesting exercise if you've ever wondered, why aren't we farming like Grandpa used to farm? What happened there between then and here? So stay tuned for that. But first, let's meet Brooke Hayes. Today, I'm excited to talk to Brooke Hayes, and Brooke kicked off her professional career with a degree in biochemistry in 1999. And then she took a 20-year break from academia to work with the BC Provincial Public Service. And boy, she worked in many and very diverse roles and files, and I believe literally worked her way from being an entry-level clerk all the way up to being an executive director. Oh yeah, and by the way, along the way, she picked up a Premier's Award in the leadership category. So needless to say, like, I was wondering, Brooke, you were in this leadership position, you had everything that somebody would think a career could bring. And then how did that go for you when you were sitting at your desk thinking, gee, maybe I should go back to being a graduate student?
When you put it that way, Nadia. Well, there we go. Let me just frame a thought here. Well, I think that what happened is that I fell in love with agriculture. When I look at my background and all of the different files and projects that I had a chance to work on, they were all interesting to me, but none of them captivated me like the subject of agriculture. And as soon as I landed in this ministry, I realized I had found my forever home in terms of topics. It brought together everything I cared about that sort of sparked interest on a personal level. There was, you know, the relationship between agriculture and health. And at one point in my career, I thought I was going to become a naturopathic doctor. So I have a year of medical training. I realized that agriculture, of course, is so connected to our environment and the quality of our ecosystems. It's connected to economics and trade. It's connected to education. I can't think of a subject that agriculture doesn't touch. And it was this opportunity to consider how agriculture is an axis upon which we can achieve policy objectives that I became really excited. And, you know, then I also became really interested in the impacts of climate change in British Columbia particularly, and discovered an opportunity to basically put carbon into the soil through specific management practices that actually created all sorts of benefits back to society. So more carbon, more organic matter in our soil, you know, has this potential to really mitigate the effects of climate change as well as adapt for the future. And this seemed to me to be just the most powerful entry point into a conversation about how we change agriculture, about how we think about it, adaptation to climate change, you know, we all care about food. And it seemed like a great place to go. And I just found that, you know, as an executive director in government, I simply wasn't able to go deep into that subject. And when I asked, you know, how can we help to accelerate activities to, you know, put more carbon in the soil in our agricultural spaces, it was, the answer was, there are all these data gaps. We don't know what's the current state of, you know, carbon capture by soil type, by commodity, by crop, by region across the province. We don't know what the, you know, the potential for this opportunity is, so we can't make a case. As well as the diversity of the province is so dramatic. We grow over 200 different commodities. We have over 17,000 farmers. Most of them are small scale. And we have, you know, 14 different biogeoclimatic regions. So we can't scale our recommendations in one area for one crop to a different area for a different crop. And so I was really just floored by this major opportunity that we had, and actually came back to school to try and fill some of these data gaps so we could make progress. I just think it's the most important thing that I personally can be doing with my time and energy. And so I decided to take the leap and also satisfy this really deep, you know, curiosity I have about agriculture and all of its impact across all of these different subject areas. So that's how I ended up back at school.
That's amazing. I think it clearly speaks to the passion that was behind this project, you know, that you took this step to go back and find out more about these things. And for our listeners here in the Peace region, I know, like, when we look at the climate projections, it's going to be pretty drastic in the Peace in terms of what may come. So I think more than ever, it's important to talk about these things.
Yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because I know most of the regions in the province have gone through a process with the Climate Action Initiative, funded by the ministry, to look at planning for climate change in an agricultural context. And the Peace region has gone through that process, as have, you know, most of the rest of the province. And what I find really interesting is that when I look at the changing conditions and how planning is being organized for those changing conditions, a couple of things stand out. One is that there's a lot of commonalities across the different regions in terms of what the priority areas are. For example, water. Water comes up as an issue over and over and over again in terms of planning for climate change adaptation and how farmers are going to be able to continue watering their crops. The second thing that comes up is that, you know, it's changing in real time. So the recommendations we're thinking about now in 30 years might look quite different. So I'm really wanting to make sure that whatever planning we're thinking about is got that longer term perspective in mind. And the third thing that really comes up when I look at that agricultural adaptation strategy is that it is devoid of any social supports and indicators of success. For not just the Peace region, but for all of the regions across the province, it's primarily focused on infrastructure, transportation networks, and economic viability of farmers, which is really important. And I think that's really critical. But what it doesn't speak to is how do we support the more kind of social side in terms of the mental health of farmers? How are we preparing to, you know, support farmers to make transitions from one type of farming to another when that might not be their status quo? And, you know, the challenges that come with these, you know, capital investments that farmers have made, how do we help them to pivot, you know, and support transitions to different types of practices? That's the part that I feel like, you know, there's more work to be done.
And I think part of the interest in your topic is that you are trying to combine, like, okay, soil carbon, we need to work on that. But how does that relate to farmers' health? And I remember when I first saw some of your presentation announcements and it said, how can soil carbon influence farmers' mental health? And I was like,
yeah,
what?
That's a good question.
How does that happen? But it makes perfect sense. And I don't know if you want to elaborate a little bit on that.
I think that'd be great. So the research question that my master's project is pursuing is interested to know if soil quality influences farmer health. and also product quality, because they're related. Agriculture, as I mentioned earlier, is multidisciplinary. So I feel like you can't look at the pressure cooker of our current state means that you can't look at one part of the system in isolation. And my premise, the sort of working model that I have around why I think this is an important question, is that I believe that you can't have a farmer working with poor quality soils that is unhealthy personally, producing a high quality product, and vice versa. So that the health of the farmer is the axis upon which we pivot on environmental and economic objectives. So what I'm curious to know is, if we see farmers adopting practices that build soil quality, because it takes time to build soil quality, it also takes time to degrade soil quality. So when we adopt practices that encourage healthy systems inside of our soil, water and nutrient cycling, for example, does that actually influence or relate in any way to farmer health? So I'm trying to see if there's a way that we can make farming a pro-health endeavor. And I think that if you looked at the entire system of agriculture and you had, 100 people in the room and you asked them, what influences farmer health, you'd probably get 150 answers. You'd get, there's lots of different ways of looking at this. And the area that I'm personally interested in is soil quality, because I'm curious to know if putting more carbon in the soil connects back to farmer health in some way. Because if it does, that gives us another reason to accelerate activities to adopt these soil carbon capturing processes. And I don't think we talk about farmers' health enough. So I feel like I'm just trying to find ways to connect things we do talk about, which is soil quality, which is product quality, and farmers' health, because I really believe we need to raise the level of that dialogue in our current conversations around agriculture.
I think as part of your exploration, you were focusing a lot on regenerative agriculture, right? In terms of helping the soils and bringing the soil organic matter back up, thereby assisting the carbon capture and all those great, amazing things that should happen with moisture and nutrients. And maybe just to recap, we have sort of five principles that we look at in regenerative agriculture. And you had kind of summarized them as, number one, keeping the soil covered. Number two, minimizing disturbance and maintaining living roots.
Yep.
Number three, the diversity, which speaks to a lot of things like diversity of crops and diversity in the system. Number four, incorporating grazing animals, yep. One of my favorites. Yep. And number five, to reduce external inputs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
This is something that comes up too when we talk about regenerative agriculture. A lot of farmers or producers may hear the word and feel ready to kind of
have their heads explode.
Maybe just turn around and walk away,
or at least
roll the eyes at you when you say that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's maybe some work to be done on that too, because if I look at the producers here in the Peace region, I can see that they've already taken a lot of steps on their own, because they are the people on the land and they're seeing what's happening, and they may have noticed by themselves, if I use rotational grazing or I use this bale grazing for my winter feeding instead of having all the manure pile up in my corral, or I'm using no-till versus tillage, they may have already implemented all these practices, right? And now we're kind of coming, or I shouldn't say we, but there is sort of that movement of, now you have to do regenerative agriculture.
Yeah.
And how can we bridge that in terms of letting people know that, guess what? You're already doing many of these things.
Yeah. No, I think it's such an important point, and language is so crucial when we talk about agriculture. I believe that farmers are not setting out to degrade their soil. And unfortunately, many of the practices that we've learned over the course of the last 50 years that are sort of conventional agriculture, are unwittingly creating damage to our ecosystems and our soil, maybe to our farmers, and that we need to open space for a conversation. And when we use a word like regenerative agriculture that can be perceived as, oh, great, new flavor of the month. What I think is really important to say is that we're just talking about good farming practices. This is kind of farming that your great-grandfather might recognize or great-grandmother might recognize. It's not something new in a way. It's sort of a return to practices that we know have worked to sustain soil quality and build soil quality over time. And when we start to break it down into the principles, it's hard to disagree with the principles. It's hard to say more diversity is bad. It's hard to say reducing external inputs is bad. I think when farmers hear, you know, reduced fertilizer costs, reduced pesticide costs, reduced irrigation cost, higher yield equals higher yield, they're probably thinking, okay, now we're having a conversation. This is something I want to hear about. It is regenerative agriculture. It's just in a different word. I also think it's really important to note that we're really struggling, I think, nationally, internationally, to define regenerative agriculture. It means something different with every person you talk to about it. And I think that just makes it a little bit difficult to have a consistent conversation about it. For example, if I look to the Ministry of Agriculture in BC right now, and I look to their regenerative agriculture profile, it sits with their agritech file, which, I mean, that's not in those principles we just talked about. That's not there. And if we look kind of across the globe to places where regenerative agriculture has a presence, like Rodale Institute, California, other places like this, you know, that's not what they're talking about. They're not talking about technology. And so I think it can be really confusing and really alienating and sort of like, well, hang on, are we talking about, you know, increasing diversity in agroforestry and rotational grazing, or are we talking about new technology? It can be very difficult to keep it straight. And because it's a new word and new language and definitions are evolving, if we can just talk about the principles, I think we're in safer ground to bridge some of that, you know, eye-rolling response, which is completely natural and totally normal. And I encourage the eye-rolling to continue, but also just create space for a little bit of openness and curiosity to what is underneath it and ask about it. Because if someone's response to what is regenerative agriculture, if they say agritech, you know, that's a cue that maybe, you know, you might want to look deeper into other places that are also defining it, like the five principles you outlined. So I just think it's evolving, it's complicated, it can be alienating, but it doesn't mean we have to stop talking about it.
That's true. Yeah. And I can only speak for the little bit of insight that I've had in the Peace region, that there seems to be a real appetite for producers wanting to improve their soil health, because ultimately, it's benefiting the bottom line. And who doesn't want that, right? So when we talk about, again, regenerative agriculture, or if we just boil it down to the principles, I sense that sometimes some producers who, because every producer is somewhere on the spectrum of moving from one place to another. So how can we make sure that nobody feels left behind? So for example, the grain grower who is definitely interested in having healthy soils and is maybe at a point where it is a no-till setup, but traditional inputs like herbicides and synthetic fertilizers are still very much part of their rotation, right?
Yeah.
So how can we make sure that these people also can feel like they're part of the discussion and can be valued for everything that they're contributing? And how can they take their next step? Because I think we also need to acknowledge how overwhelming it can be if all these things are being put on a producer or a farmer, and there's a lot of money invested, there's a lot of commitments, and we can't just from one day to the other decide to throw it all out of the window. What are your thoughts? Like, do you have any ideas on how we could support producers along that spectrum?
Yeah, I do. And I just wanted to emphasize and echo what you said there, that it's not a black and white situation for most farmers in terms of sort of a conventional definition or a regenerative definition, that in fact, most farmers are somewhere on the spectrum between adoption of some practices or another. So definitely it's not black and white. And I think you've raised a really important question about how we recognize farmers that are already doing good things. And what I am aware of is that for years, farmers in various forms through associations or individually have been asking for the good things that they're doing already to be recognized. And the concept of ecosystem goods and services, like payment for ecological and ecosystem goods and services, has come up over and over and over again as a policy idea, where we can effectively pay farmers to capture carbon in their soil and for the adoption of good practices. And as I mentioned, that the data gaps that we have across the province have really made it challenging to say how much we should pay for the adoption of specific kinds of practices, because the amount of benefit is dependent on multiple factors like the climate in that place and the other types of management practices and the soil quality, the soil texture, time. You know, there's so many different factors that can influence what the actual benefit is of adopting those practices that it's almost impossible at a provincial level to say, okay, farmer, you've adopted no-till in this region for this crop, and therefore we will give you this benefit. We just don't have that data to be able to do that at a provincial level. So I think it's probably 10, 15, 20, maybe longer years away before a system like that is in place for a province as complex as British Columbia. But that said, I think we know enough. We know enough about practices that support soil quality that we can start to help farmers transition to these good practices. And so that's partly why I think this research is important, is because it's going to help us say, when a farmer adopts these specific management practices in these specific crops, in these specific regions, these are the benefits we're seeing. So we can start to articulate something beyond just an economic value of these elements. So how do we help farmers feel valued and to take those next steps? I mean, I really believe that means creating a safe space for farmers to transition to new practices. And right now, we know that transitioning from a quote conventional farming practice that might be heavily invested in infrastructure and capital to something that is more regenerative, you know, to see a benefit from that can take 3 to 5 years. It's not a, you know, you can buy this piece of equipment or you can put in place this new practice and instantly you're going to see a shift. It requires a long-term commitment. And I think that right now, we don't have the correct sort of insurance schemes to help farmers know that if their first year or second year or third year of transition isn't successful, that they're not going to be, you know, even more stretched. So I feel like looking at those programs to help transition farmers, to give them safe space to transition and then measure impacts would be a really useful starting point. To just help for those farmers that do want to make those transitions and are willing to change their practices. Not everyone is ready. You know, there's lots of farmers that are really, you know, what's working for them is working for them, and they haven't seen the pressures due to climate change or the commodities that they're working within to kind of necessitate it. So, you know, for those farmers that do recognize it, for those farmers that do see value in putting carbon in the soil, who do want to do things like increase biodiversity at their locations or try these other practices, I think a support network for those farmers to help them work with what they have, work with the equipment that they have, and help give them plans would be amazing. But to do that would require, you know, a great network of extension support professionals and people that understand how to do this. And you know, I think, as you know, those resources, for the most part, have been kind of decimated across the province since the 80s and 90s. And so I think farmers are often like facing a lot of this stuff alone. And so I think, you know, giving farmers that support work network and some resources to help them with that transition, help them understand, you know, these are the tweaks you can make this year, this the following year, and just test it and see what's working. Those are all ingredients to success and are probably places to start. But as I'm not with the ministry anymore, I'll be making recommendations to the ministry for how they might want to tackle that.
That sounds like a great idea. One suggestion that somebody shared with me was if we had something more like a fitness or a health program where you sort of pay a producer in those transition years, right? Where maybe you help them out with covering the seed cost of putting in a cover crop or some sort of compensation payment for putting a parcel into that kind of fitness program to help the soils be transitioned into a new system, right? Rather than having sort of the healthcare at the back end where you're just paying for a crop loss or a crop failure, right? So who knows? I think there's lots of great minds that have ideas on how we could support.
Yeah. I'll also just comment that I don't think it's only government's responsibility, that there is a responsibility that is actually to universities who have a traditional role in sharing information about practices that comes from research with farmers, that network and the opportunity to do research in partnership with farmers has really kind of been broken over the last couple of decades, and we need to restore some of that so that we can have better partnerships. And a great example of that is down in California, where farmers are able to work with universities to adopt very basic practices, sometimes as simple as mulching, cover cropping, sometimes a bit more complex like agroforestry or integration of livestock. What they do is they pair them with researchers who come out and measure the before and after and then use their sites as demo sites for local surrounding farmers to show kind of what's possible. And I think, you know, that's really important, that we don't think of this just as a cost covering exercise, but as a shared learning experience, because as I mentioned, things are changing in real time. What worked yesterday, what worked in a different region, may not work tomorrow, may not work in this region. So we need to have those relationships, I believe, on the ground to really help others to come along with the process.
And I think, too, that would also help validating some of the anecdotal experiences that producers are seeing on the land, right? That maybe they try something and they observe something, but because nobody was there to measure it, it sometimes isn't taken as serious as like the academic study next to it.
Yeah, I know. And unfortunately, the academic studies come out and they're also not accessible, right? Because they're often written in a language that doesn't make any sense to anyone except the person who wrote it or the people at the center of that subject. So, you know, we need translators. We need some translators for this is the experience I had on my farm, and this is what I think the benefit was, to a place that can then amplify that and sort of make some of these practices contagious, you know, help to accelerate others to see the benefit of them.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think along that way, if that relationship was mended a bit between academia and the applied producer, and we had a bit of more of that translation and maybe field scale demonstrations, and I think it would also empower the producers to have possibly simple methods how they can document things on their land, which I think is fascinating when you can see like, oh my gosh, look at this number, it changed. That means something is happening.
There's some wonderful resources out there for people who are interested in how do I know if my soil is, you know, functioning well the way that I want it to in terms of water and nutrient cycles and carbon cycles. And I'm not the expert in these things, but there are some really simple things that farmers can do to test the quality of their soil that doesn't require them to send away their soil samples to a lab. And I think that, you know, even just that ability to say, you know, here's a method to test the water infiltration capacity of your soil. And we know that soil that's higher in soil organic carbon has better infiltration, better storage of that water, which means you irrigate less, you know, then that gives a farmer a piece of information that they can then track over the course of the year, over the course of multiple years, and, you know, can help them to make decisions on the farm. We know that farmers are relying on each other and their neighbors much more than they are right now, at least on academic and government resources. So giving farmers the tools so they can communicate with each other feels like a really simple first step. And, you know, some testing that can be done on farm without specialized equipment, without an intermediary seems to me to be a really reasonable and useful starting point as well.
And I just want to mention this number because I love it in terms of increased soil water holding capacity. From what I've seen in findings, it seems if you increase your soil organic matter by 1%, like 1%, you could have over 90,000 liters more water holding capacity
per acre.
It could solve irrigation issues, drought problems that are likely going to our region is going to be faced with. It could be tremendous. It could also help when we have a torrential downpour that
you actually like the best place to store your water is in the soil. Not a cistern, not in the clouds, not in a dam or a dugout, in the soil. And we can absolutely increase the amount of water holding capacity in our soil. That is a tremendous opportunity.
Welcome back. To stay in the line of looking at how adaptations are implemented on the farm, let's have a look at the Forage Fact Sheet Vault and Forage Fact Sheet number 117, which looks at innovation and farm decision making. Much of the information presented in this fact sheet was actually part of a presentation given at the Agricultural Climate Adaptation Research Workshop back in 2018 in Kamloops. The question kind of looks at how does adaptation work on a farm? How do we know something and then move to the decision to implement it on the farm or maybe not implement it on the farm? Over its almost 30-year history, the Peace River Forage Association of BC has worked to support ranchers and farmers in their decision-making by helping them beyond just the sharing of knowledge. Much of the work done in the Peace region by local agricultural associations, researchers, technicians, and professionals is to work with producers around making the decisions to try a new idea and then to evaluate its success on their own farming operation. If failure or less than desirable results occur, it is important to assess if the innovation needed to be tweaked and maybe retried or actually rejected for right now. The cycle of adaptation is a tool outlined in fact sheet number 117. It also touches on the fact that producers have very different learning styles, which also should be considered when trying to implement new adaptations on a farming operation. Now, if you run a farm, you know that decision-making is a darn complex process. The fact sheet number 117 breaks it down into 7 steps. So let's work through them and see how careful consideration of the complexity of change that may occur on the farming operation and evaluating the ripple effects that it may have can be a basis of making decisions on your farming operation to see if the adoption of a new innovative practice is meaningful on your farm or should be reconsidered at this point. If a producer or cooperator is first interested in doing a demonstration on their farming operation, there are some questions that should be asked first to get an idea of where the farm business is at. If you yourself would like to implement a demonstration on your farm to see if a practice works on your own operation, the first component in the 7-step decision-making matrix is looking at your farm business reality. Here are some questions that you could ask yourself before you start out on a demonstration to discover what it actually is that you would like to find out on your operation. Where's your farm at? What are your personal interests and strengths? What is your forage production like? On your entire farm or by field? How is your soil health? What is your financial status? Just take a few minutes and work through these questions. The next part of the discussion is exploring what the farm opportunities actually are. Some guiding questions here could be, what are your goals for production? Would you like to expand or maintain? Would you like to improve performance? Are there some environmental challenges you would like to consider? Once you have a clear picture of what it is you would like to tackle in relationship to your farming operation, we can look at quick tools that can help you assess the status of your situation. For example, can you use forage stand indicators? What does your topsoil look like? Can you look at aerial photographs and maps? Are there drone images that you can look at? Can the forage seeding tool maybe help? Do you have partial budgets for a project? Now that you have some bits and pieces, it's important to set priorities. That can be done in 2 stages. Stage 1 is a quick assessment where you quickly assess the feasibility, outcome, and practicality of something that you would like to implement. You identify obstacles and move on. Stage 2 of setting priorities takes a deeper look. For example, you're sitting down and analyze the whole situation in more detail. Are there any adjustments to management that are needed? Does it fit your operation? What about the financial investment that might be needed? What ideas do you have around implementing your plan? For example, you might work through this exercise and determine that it might make more sense to invest in bale grazing rather than plow or rejuvenate the forage stand. Or another producer example might be that you identify that the main obstacle for your operation to expand is a handling facility that you need to do health checks and market your animals. Now that you have done some background work and you've thought about what you would like to implement and what your goals are, it's time to make some decisions. This is the exciting part where you get to take action. For example, are you going to rejuvenate, reseed a field, overseed a field? Maybe you're going to enhance a stand by improving soil quality, add some fertility or other nutrients that appear to be missing. You're going to maybe control some weeds, add fencing, a watering system, develop a feeding or grazing plan, or any other actions that you came up with. Now, after you've had all this fun of implementing your actions, it is important to monitor your success. That is actually one of the more important steps in the process of deciding whether to adopt an innovation on your farming operation and to see whether it was actually successful or needs some tweaking. A great way to monitor success is to set up a benchmark. For example, you have a specific spot in the field where you measure yield year after year. Maybe you have a photo sequence of the same spot so you can compare what it looked like. Maybe you're going to weigh the bales that you harvested from the field and see if you had more bales and heavier bales. You can also measure success in more financial terms, such as how were my livestock sales or how was my cost versus my returns. With that, you have walked yourself through the 7 steps of decision making, and now you can start all over again with a new project or tweak your project and try it again. Now, I mentioned the question of how did it happen that your grandpa or great-grandpa farmed somewhat differently than you farm today? Yes, for sure, there was innovation of technologies, but how did those technologies come to be adopted on your farming operation? You've probably seen the bell curve that compares the times at which people will adapt a new innovation. There are the innovators, which are usually a small percentage of early adopters that like to be cutting edge, have a high tolerance for risk and uncertainty, and are kind of adventurous and change initiators. The innovators only make up about 2.5% of the total population that's going through an adoption. Then we have the early adopters. They like to embrace change. They like self-efficacy, like to be the first to try something and try out new ideas, but still in a somewhat careful way. The early adopters make up about 13.5% of the total pie. Then we have the early majority, a 34% chunk of people that accept change with deliberate action. They adopt change if it's practical and the pros outweigh the cons. Now that makes up half of the pie. The remainder makes up the late majority, another 34%, which often adopt out of necessity, but not necessarily out of choice. And then at the very tail end, we have the late adopters, about 16%, which makes up the rest of the pie. Those people are a bit more suspicious of innovation, and they often wait until they're forced to adopt an innovation. Now, it doesn't matter which group you belong to. No group is better or worse than the other. It's just how the whole pie comes together. And it would be a boring place if we were all the same type of people and the same type of innovation adopter. One thing to consider in all of this is that people have different learning styles. Some people are auditory learners. You might be one of them if you're listening to this podcast. Others learn best by seeing something, and others yet, which includes many farmers and ranchers, learn by doing. So new ideas need to be presented in all these different forms that everybody can have an effective learning opportunity.
This is why on-farm demonstrations are such an effective tool for technology transfer, because it enables farmers and researchers to work together through the 7-step decision-making process of whether to adopt or tweak or maybe not adopt. In summary, Forage Fact Sheet number 117 offers some key messages. The decision whether to adopt an innovation is often complex. Acknowledge your reality, know who you are, and proceed accordingly. Be candid with yourself and your team. Seek the information and insights that you need on your farm. And finally, remember that change or innovation should fit your operation. And ask yourself, what interests and skills are available? How will my daily routine change? What options do we have if issues arise? With all those questions in your head, I'm going to send you off to dream up your own adaptation and innovation project that you could test on your operation. I always wondered how we could improve the forage production on this field over the hill. All joking aside, if you do have a forage demonstration project that you would like to see tried out or maybe tried out on your operation, please feel free to reach out to the Peace River Forage Association and you just might get featured as the next forage innovation project. You can always reach us at coordinator@peaceforage.bc.ca. Please like and share this podcast so the word can get out and we can spread the forage love across the region. So long! May the forage be with you.